All right, hello everyone. And I just want to say I really enjoyed your teaching. I only got to hear the last 30 minutes because I was away from the house in the first 30 minutes. And I forgot to take my phone so I couldn't listen in the car. But I loved what I heard. So thank you so much for allowing that clarity to come through you. You haven't been teaching here that long, and I remember when you first started, you were kind of married to reading from a book. Do you remember that? I think I like, it's kind of like the mother bird pushing the baby out of the nest. I'm like, put down the book, get rid of that book. I don't think I said it quite that way, but try reading from your journal instead or whatever. And oh my goodness, what a difference in such a short time. So thank you. Thank you for listening and for finding out exactly what I learned about teaching. I think that's what you're learning, right? That teaching done right, it's very hard to describe how to do it right, but it's not planning right. It's not thinking about what you're going to say. It's just opening your mouth and letting it happen. Teaching is such, it's just such a magnificent way of awakening ourselves. And I can tell, Anne, that you are doing that. And I just want to say thank you for being brave. I know it took bravery. I also want to say I'm feeling a little sentimental. Because do you know when I started that journey of awakening through teaching? It was in April of 2005. And do you know where it was? Right here in Pal-Talk. And do you know what today is? The last day in Pal-Talk. I can actually even feel little tears welling up in the back of my eyes. It's just like, as Ken said, it's like we're saying goodbye to an old friend. He said that to me in a text. Saying goodbye to an old friend today. I have gained so much from teaching in Pal-Talk, and I'm sure Zoom will be just as wonderful, but still, I'm saying goodbye to Pal-Talk today. So tonight at what time am I on? 8:30 p.m. Eastern, I think, Ken. I should know that. I should show up. 9:30, right? 7:30 my time. 9:30 p.m. Eastern tonight. I will do my final teaching in Pal-Talk. Wow. So if y'all aren't doing anything, probably won't be anything spectacular, but it will be the final one. So if you want to come and listen tonight, it's I Am That, 9:30 Eastern Time, 7:30 Mountain, and that would be what, 5:30 Pacific. Right now, we're here for my sharing from the Tao Te Ching, which again, the focus of this sharing is enlightened leadership. And really, what we've done so far is we've come up with what I call lesson number one. Lesson number one, don't want anything. Don't want anything. And I'll tell you what, that is so different from what the world teaches you about leadership. The world teaches you to make a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan. You have to know where the heck you're going. Right? You have to want something. You have to know where the heck you're going. And then you control everything like crazy to get to those goals if at all possible. And the first lesson we have out of the Tao Te Ching is don't want anything. I mean, to some of the world leaders, and by world leaders, I don't necessarily mean politicians, although they can be included, but I mean people who run restaurants, the manager at JCPenney's, right? People who run the CEOs of companies, if we told them that the best way to lead is by not wanting anything, they would laugh. And in fact, somewhere in the Tao, we'll get to it eventually, it talks about how when the foolish man hears the Tao, he laughs. That's exactly what it says, and that's exactly what they do. So this is the opposite, really, of what any of us were probably taught about leadership. Dolores is in the house. I think if I remember the Pal-Talk handle well. Yep, Dolores. And Dolores, I don't know, I haven't seen you around lately, so I hope you know today's our last day in Pal-Talk, that we're moving to Zoom. So this is exactly the opposite of what we have learned about leadership. And therefore, one thing that can happen when we hear these teachings is we can agree and still fall back into our old way of leadership. And that's what we need to be aware of, right? It's kind of like NTI says, and I think it's the Book of James, You know, if you listen to me and agree and then, walk away and do not practice, it's like a man who looks in the mirror, recognizes himself, and then walks away and forgets what he saw, right? We need to really embrace these lessons, and I hope that we don't move through this too quickly, so that we are unable to embrace them. Right? I hope that we move through at a nice pace, where we're able to really contemplate these lessons and embody them. I mean, that is the purpose of this teaching, at least for me. It's to embody these teachings. Lesson number one, don't want anything. Right? Completely the opposite of what we've been taught about leadership. And so today we'll see if we come up with lesson number two. We're in verse two. This is my third week, fourth week, I think. We're in verse two. Maybe it's my third week. I don't remember. No, it's my, yeah, who knows? I think it's my third week. We went over the first part of verse two last time. This time we're going over the second part of verse two, but I'm going to read all of verse two just to get us back in the groove. For those of you who don't know, this time I decided to pick up a version of the Tao Te Ching that I hadn't read before. It's a translation by Derek Lin, L-I-N, Derek Lin. So it gives me a little bit of freshness because it's a new translation, and every translation of the Tao is different. So if this translation sounds a little different to you, that's why. Okay, and Ken is saying it's my third week. Thank you, Ken. All right, so here is verse two. When the world knows beauty as beauty, ugliness arises. When it knows good as good, evil arises. Thus being and non-being produce each other. Difficult and easy bring about each other. Long and short reveal each other. High and low support each other. Music and voice harmonize each other. Front and back follow each other. And that's the part that we looked at last time. So that's on the last recording. This is the part that we'll begin looking at today. Therefore, the sages manage the work of detached actions. Conduct the teaching of no words. They work with the myriad things, but do not control. They create, but do not possess. They act, but do not presume. They succeed, but do not dwell on success. It is because they do not dwell on success that it, meaning success, never goes away. So what I want to do is look at this second part line by line. It's talking about the sages, which we're going to call the enlightened leaders. The first thing that enlightened leaders do, they manage the work of detached actions. Now, in this particular case, the word manage is not referring to outward management. You know, like usually when a leader is managing employees, right, or managing the business, again, it's an outward focus, and it's actually a control-focused management, the word management. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and look up the word management, or manage, I guess. I'll just look up the word manage. Let's see exactly what the dictionary has to say about manage. Okay, so it says to be in charge of, right? To be in charge of. So it's an outward management. One of the sub definitions uses control the use of. Here's another one, maintain control, right? Another one, administer and regulate, right? It's an outward focused word typically, the word manage, right? You're trying to, first of all, you're wanting something. And then two, you're trying to control people and resources and situations in order to attain what you want. That's usually what the word manage means. And a good leader is successful at this wanting something and then controlling in order to achieve what he or she wanted, right? Well, the word manage is being used here, but the sense that I get is, again, it's just like, the first lesson was completely opposite of the first lesson we learned in worldly leadership, right? The first lesson was do not want anything, exactly the opposite of goal setting, which is what we learn in worldly leadership. The word manage is also just the opposite. Just the opposite of what the word manage means to the world. The word manage here is an inward focused attention rather than an outward focused attention. And it's not a controlling attention. There's got to be another word you can use here because it's not controlling. Whenever I attempt to control even myself, I can feel that I'm an ego, right? But there's a disciplined way of keeping yourself on track that's not controlled. Do you have a word for that? It's not controlling, but it's not completely undisciplined either. Shepherding is the word she's using, an inward focused shepherding of myself. I like that. I like that very much, right? Because the shepherd guides the sheep in the direction they're supposed to go. I like that. I'll use that word, shepherding. Manage here is an inward focused shepherding of myself. It's not about the outside world that I appear to manage, right? And so it says that I am managing the work, so this would be my work, right? Managing the work of detached actions. Really, that's keeping me aligned with lesson number one, don't want anything. As soon as you want something, you're no longer detached. You're then attached to whatever you have decided that you want. So manage the work of detached actions means that I need to keep myself, I need to shepherd myself so that I stay in harmony with lesson number one and don't slip into wanting something. Now, again, what's really interesting about the Tao Te Ching is the Tao Te Ching never denies that you may be physically doing all the same things that another restaurant manager would do, that another general in the army would do, that another leader of a spiritual organization would do, that another mother would do. Like on the outside, you may look not at all different, except maybe the really discerning eye may see a difference, right? And this is where we have to be careful about judging because, again, the judging eye is often an outward focused eye. We can also judge inwardly. But, if we misunderstand the Tao, we could be looking at someone that is genuinely, completely in harmony with the Tao and say to ourselves, that person's not in harmony with the Tao. They're trying to accomplish things. When actually, inwardly, they're completely detached. They don't want anything. They're just doing what comes to them to be done. They don't want anything. They also aren't resisting anything. And maybe that's the second part of what we need to look at here. Because it's true that you are attached if you want something, right? We all know that. But you're also attached if you're trying to avoid something. I mean, really, trying to avoid something is just another kind of wanting, right? It may not be wanting to get or obtain, it's wanting to keep away or avoid, right? So the only way that I can be detached is if I'm just taking what's coming, what needs to be done, and doing it because it has come. It has arrived, it needs to be done. I can see it needs to be done. I can see it's my job to do it. And so I do it. And then when it's done, it's done. And then something else comes, right? It has to be detached, and that I'm not trying to get anything. I'm not trying to avoid anything. I'm just being with what's here. I'm just being with what's here. And again, unless you also know detached action as an inward experience, if you're very attached to everything that you do, either trying to get or trying to avoid, then you probably perceive others as attached too, when they may not be necessarily. So one thing that we all need to remember about the Tao, especially those of us who are here to learn enlightened leadership, is this is about me, which isn't that always true about any spiritual teaching. This is about me. I am to inwardly manage, inwardly shepherd myself to make sure I am detached. You know, recently I read the biography, or one of the biographies, about St. Francis. And you never know when you read a historical biography what's true and what's not true. You know, if you're wise. If you're not wise, you might believe everything you read. But if you're wise, you never know what's true or what's not true. And in fact, the historical biographer is learning what he or she can about this person who lived, you know, hundreds of years ago. But this person, when they write the biography, they cannot help but write with interpretation. We've just learned about interpretation in TI Revelation. So you never know how much of what they say about a person is true, what actually happened, or how much of that is just their projection on the little bit they learned, and then they kind of imagined the rest and didn't know they were imagining it. So I'm going to share something. The reason I said all that is I'm going to share something I read in a biography, but I got to say up front that this, you know, we have to listen to this kind of like you listen to a story with a moral, rather than saying, oh, that's what happened. Because the truth is we don't know what happened, right? Truth is, we don't know what happened. But I recently read a biography about St. Francis, and one of the points that this biography made was that St. Francis became very frustrated as the leader of the Franciscan friars because his followers did not have the commitment, the devotion, the love of the purpose that he had. Only a few, only very few. The ones closest to him, really the first friars, all those that came on later, they just didn't. They were much more worldly in their approach to it. And he became very, very frustrated with this, is the way the biographer wrote it, to the point that he gave up his role. He was called Minister General, I think, Minister General, gave up his role of Minister General and went back to being a friar minor. Well, I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, I'm sure he gave up his role as Minister General. That's pretty much documented. But exactly why, what his motivations were, who knows? It may have just been guidance. But let's go with that idea for a moment, that he was frustrated because he now had thousands of friars in his organization. I think 5,000 was the number I read, 5,000 friars. But the vast majority of them were still very, very worldly focused, right? And he was frustrated. Well, the only way to become frustrated is to be looking out. To be looking out and wanting the followers to be as devoted as you. It's the only way to become frustrated, right? So if that happened, it was a mistake. Whether it happened or not is irrelevant. We can still learn from the story that it happened, right? Realizing that it is just a story and it may not have happened that way at all. But we can still learn from the story. That's what's wonderful about stories. They can have very good morals that we can learn from, right? The moral of the story is, this line says, manage the work of detached actions. It's talking about It's talking about inward shepherding to make sure I want nothing, nothing, nothing. Not even that others understand me, that others are as devoted as me, right? That they love the practice as much as I love. That's still wanting something, isn't it? Once upon a time, here's another story, except it's a, you know, kind of a true story. Once upon a time, I was at a retreat in New Hampshire, and I didn't drink at all. Now, occasionally I have wine with dinner and stuff, but back then I didn't drink at all. And I was invited by some people at the retreat. Now imagine this. Are you ready? I was at a retreat. I was a speaker at the retreat. And I was invited to skip a portion of the retreat and go to a vodka party. And you can just imagine what my response was. No, I'm not doing that. You know, I'm not doing that. You know, I want to go to the retreat. So I did. I went to the retreat, you know, even though I wasn't on then. I went to the retreat and I was sitting listening to whoever was speaking at the time. And all of a sudden, my body just stood up. And I realized, I'm going to that vodka party. And the funny thing was, I didn't even know where this party was. Didn't even know where it was. And this is a fairly huge campus. But my body walked directly into this one building, and as soon as I got in the building, I heard the noise of the vodka party, and from there, I was able to find it. So like I was literally led right to it, and I walk in, and they pour me a vodka, which I didn't even drink. I was there like 2 hours, and I only took a couple sips of it. I didn't even finish it. But while I was there, I met someone. Some of you may have heard we talk about her. You may remember when she was with me. Her name was Debbie. And, you know, my memory is a little vague now, so I won't go into too many details. If you hear stories told that closer to when it happened, you'll hear very specific details back from when I remembered what exactly what happened. But vaguely what I remember now is that I started receiving this guidance to invite her to live with me. Now, what was really interesting about this is she was talking. I mean, if you knew Debbie, she was a talker. She'd tell you her whole life story in the first 30 minutes that you met her. So I learned right off the bat, she just got out of prison. She was had been, before she went to prison, she'd been addicted to meth. Is that the right word? Meth. She was a thief. And we're not talking a little bitty thief. We're talking a major professional thief. And, you know, I'm getting this guidance, invite her to live with you. And I remember I was like, you know what, if this is genuine guidance, I will do it. But I had a little kid at home, a daughter at home, right? She was 12 or 13 at the time. You know, my worldly mind is saying, you can't invite this kind of person into your house when Jasmine is, you know, at such an impressionable age. You're like, this is not a good idea, right? But you, if you guys know me, you know one thing I do is I surrender, no matter what the heck it is. But what I said to Holy Spirit at the time is, I said, if this is guidance, I will do this. But I need confirmation. And I don't remember now what the confirmation was, but there were literally three very clear confirmations that came within 24 hours. One of which was, we were in Hampshire. I lived in North Carolina at the time, and Debbie happened to say out loud, oh, I'm going to North Carolina next week, you know, or something like that, you know. And I don't remember what the others were, but I just kept knowing, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, you are going to invite this woman to live with you. And I did. I invited her to live with me. And that was just as we were getting ready to move here. So she actually moved to Pueblo with us and lived with us for the first, I think it was 9 months that we were here. After I accepted the guidance and invited Debbie to live with me, at least the way I remember it was after, it might have been before, but I did receive another piece of guidance about this guidance. The guidance was to invite her to live with me, but I received guidance about the guidance. And the guidance that I received was not to be concerned about whether she healed or not. You know, so here I have this meth, ex-meth addict, thief, ex-prisoner, stranger, that I'm inviting into my home, and I'm not to be concerned about whether she heals or not. That's don't want anything. Do you see? If I wanted anything, I couldn't have followed that guidance. That's don't want anything. If I wanted Jasmine not to be influenced, I could not have followed that guidance. If I wanted to be the one that saved Debbie from herself, I could not have followed that guidance. Don't want anything. And Debbie did not heal. I don't have this great story to tell you about how, oh, and she healed and, you know, she's happy now. She did not heal. And there were certainly things that happened in the house. One thing that started happening was she did not go back to meth, assuming I'm using the right word there. Some of you guys probably know the drugs better than I do. But, yeah, that's the right word, meth. Okay, she did not go back to meth. But she did know this 90-something-year-old psychiatrist in California. And she could get any drug she wanted from him. And so she got prescriptions and filled these prescriptions of drugs. And then she would drink alcohol with them, so she would get wasted. She'd do things like, you know, pull a pan out of the cabinet and drop it on the floor, you know, fall down the stairs. I mean, she was a mess. And I remember one day standing there doing dishes. I just felt so sad, sad for her. I just felt so sad because it was clear how she was hurting herself and what a wonderful opportunity she had here. I mean, it was her and me and Jasmine and Danielle. And if anybody knows anything about me and Jasmine and Danielle together, I mean, that's a good group of people to be with. That's a happy, you know, good, well-adjusted group of people to be with. You know, I don't want to sound like I'm bragging here, but if you get to live with me and Jasmine and Danielle, which nobody else will because we no longer live together, but I mean, wow, you're lucky. And she lived with us. And she didn't see that. And she didn't see the opportunity that was right there. And just one night doing dishes, I just started feeling really sad. And then it hit me like a ton of bricks. I had slipped into wanting something. How else could I be sad? I did want Debbie to heal. Right? And then I remembered the guidance. Don't be concerned whether she heals or not. And I realized Debbie moving in with me was not about Debbie healing. This was about me letting go of something else. Attachment. This was about me letting go of wanting anything. I mean, I used to say that Holy Spirit would hit me over the head with a marshmallow bat, you know, to wake me up, right? It was like getting hit over the head with a marshmallow bat. Duh, it's about me. It's about me. And that's when I got to work. That's when I began to manage the work of detached actions. That's when I got to work of letting go of any desire for Debbie to heal. My only job was to be there, right? Doing whatever was in front of me to do in the moment. Interestingly, I guess there is a little bit of a happy ending to this. It wasn't long after that when Debbie began to see for herself that she was on a very dark downward spiral. And she didn't accept the invitation to move in with us because she wanted to go down. She accepted the invitation to move in with us because she wanted to heal. And so she decided that she wanted to quit taking those prescription drugs. And unfortunately, the prescription drugs she was on were very dangerous. And fortunately, this is another miracle. There are miracles in the story after all. Fortunately, I happened to casually mention to a doctor that was a friend of mine on the phone that Debbie was going to quit these drugs, and the doctor went, "Ah, she can't just quit those, it'll kill her." And the doctor quickly wrote another prescription and gave me instructions on how to wean her from the drugs and all of that. And so, under a doctor's guidance, I was able to help her get off of those drugs. And to my knowledge, Debbie has not gone back to being addicted to drugs. And I haven't talked to her in a few years, but I certainly was in touch with her for several years after that. And to my knowledge, she was able to stay off the drugs. There's certainly other things that still needed to heal, but there was a step forward there. It was a few months after that that she left because her mother got cancer. Her mother was taking care of her daughter while she was living with me, and her mother got cancer and began to die. So Debbie needed to go home and resume the role of motherhood. Oh yeah, I see what Dolores is writing. My dad is on home hospice. I am at his bedside. I don't want him to transition. Yeah, I mean, first of all, Dolores, we all understand that. And secondly, I don't know when, but he will transition. We all do. So, wisdom, real wisdom, would say that not wanting someone to transition, especially when it is their time, is a bit like beating your head against a wall. It's something you have no control over. My recommendation, if you care, is instead of not wanting him to transition, instead just be with him as he is. Just embrace this opportunity to be with him. Jay says both parents have already passed. Neither of mine have. So, but we all go through it, as my dad would say, if we're lucky. Now, my dad would say, if we're lucky, we all experience the death of our parents. And what he means by that is, from his perspective, there's nothing worse than experiencing the death of a child. He would rather see the child experience the death of the parent, right? He likes things to happen in the natural order of things. I saw something on TV the other night. I don't watch TV really, but I was at my dad's house last week and they watch TV and I can barely remember it. But I saw something on TV. In fact, it's already leaving me, so I can't even pull it in long enough to say it. We'll see if it comes back. It's very related to this, but I'm already losing it. So it left, so I guess it wasn't meant to be said. So we've spent all this time on this one sentence. But I think we get the point now. Manage the work of detached actions is an inward shepherding to make sure I'm not attached to wanting anything or trying to avoid anything, right? Anything, anything, anything. Oh my God. As you can imagine, that's going to require some inward shepherding. That's not just going to happen, right? Now, the second one, conduct the teaching of no words. Now, the way I am seeing this, I mean, we have the idea of Ramana Maharshi, who used to just sit there in the meditation hall and people would come and he would do nothing, say nothing, not even look at them sometimes. But I don't think this is talking about the Ramana Maharshi model. Because the Tao is a book written for kings. And kings worked just like I work. They had kingdoms that they were responsible for. So conduct the teaching of no words. The way that I'm hearing that is be the teaching. Just be the teaching. You don't go around telling everyone. Again, this would be outward management. You don't go around telling everyone who works for you, don't be detached. You can't be detached. Let go of wanting that. You're wanting too much. If you're going around trying to control everyone else, to make sure they're being detached. You're not following the inward shepherding. Again, you've slipped into wanting something. That's the slipping into that maybe St. Francis did, right? Conduct the teaching of no words to me means be the teaching. Be it yourself. You know, if there are those around who are going to see it, they're going to see it. I don't know if Jay knows this, but he gave me a tremendous compliment recently. I think it was when we were on the Italy trip. And I can't even remember the compliment specifically. I remember the general feeling of the compliment rather than the specific words of the compliment. But the general feeling of the compliment was, he said something about he was beginning to watch me and he was beginning to notice things. You know, notice, you know, for example, that maybe I'm not attached to something, right? He was beginning to see, he was beginning to watch me, and he was beginning to see the teaching in me. You know, that's a wonderful compliment, you know, because it means that I be the teaching. But it's also, I got to be honest, that's what makes a great devotee or disciple or whatever words you want to use there. You know, the person who can watch the teacher and notice the little things that nobody else sees, and then start embodying it yourself. Right? Start embodying it yourself. That's a great devotee or a great disciple or a great student, or whatever word you want to use there. And so when this says conduct the teaching of no words, it's asking the enlightened leaders, just live this yourself. Those who are ready to see will see. It will be a teaching to those who are ready. And to those who aren't ready, the words wouldn't help anyway. You know, again, they might agree, but they're not going to follow them, right? It's going to be intellectual. So be the teaching, and then the teaching will naturally radiate to those who are ready to see it. Manage the work of detached actions. Conduct the teaching of no words. Now it says that the sages work with myriad things, but do not control. And again, what this means to me is, from the outside, you may not notice the difference between an enlightened teacher and an unenlightened teacher. Well, maybe you will. I mean, maybe, you know, like, you know, maybe you will notice that the enlightened teacher isn't telling you what a lazy ass you are, and if you screw up one more time, you're fired. Maybe you'll notice that. Maybe you won't. Maybe you won't notice how they're handling things differently, right? You might notice the unenlightened teacher before you notice the enlightened teacher. In fact, I think that's probably true. You might notice the unenlightened teacher before you notice the enlightened teacher, because the unenlightened teacher is, you know, or so I'm using the word teacher, I should be saying leader, unenlightened leader. The unenlightened leader, you know, has an abrasiveness or a foolishness or something that you may really, really notice. So you notice them. In fact, I remember once reading that the number one reason people change jobs is because of the boss, right? So people do notice the unenlightened teacher or leader. I got to get stuck on that. Leader, leader, leader. People do notice the unenlightened leader. You might not notice an enlightened leader, right? The enlightened leader may be so much a part of the flow that you, in a way, don't even notice. In fact, somewhere in the Tao Te Ching, it says something about, you know, when you are the enlightened leader, it doesn't use those words, but when you are the enlightened leader, the people will say, we did it ourselves. Right? Like you're not even noticed, which does mean an enlightened leader can't be looking for credit. I told Jacqueline recently, because it happened with us, and of course, you know, Jacqueline and I are very close. So I was telling her that, you know, one thing that happens, which I just giggle at, but, you know, I'll teach things, you know, for years. I'll teach something for years. Pick a teaching. And there'll be somebody there who's always there, always hearing the teaching. And then one day I hear them say something like, oh, do you know what I just realized? And it's that. Or, you know what I heard Muji say today? And it's that, you know. I was telling Jacqueline, because I can't remember what it was, but she did that one day when she was teaching. She says, you know what I heard from Adyashanti today? And I was like, okay. Not that I haven't been saying that for the last 10 years. But you know what? I just laugh at that. It doesn't really bother me. Because A, it's just the way it is. Nobody realizes anything until they realize it for themselves. You know, whether it happens to be coming out of your mouth or somebody else's mouth or out of their hand when they're journaling, you know, they're not going to realize it till they realize it for themselves anyway. You can't actually teach anyone anything, and I know that. I can teach myself, end of story, right? I know that. So I just laugh when it happens. But my point for telling this story is an unenlightened teacher wants the credit. Sorry, I said teacher again, leader. My dad used to tell me teachers and leaders are the same thing. Let me just go back to dad for a second. He used to say that a good leader is a teacher, right? And maybe that's why I keep mixing the words up, because really I think the Tao is saying the same thing, right? It says conduct the teaching of no words, right? You are a teacher through the way you be the teaching, right? So a leader and a teacher are the same thing. Yeah, Jay says his dad told him the same thing. But an unenlightened teacher who's trying to practice the Tao wants the credit, wants you to see I'm practicing the Tao, right? Did you notice over there that I was not attached? Did you see that? Did you see? Did you notice I just let go, right? Did you see that? Right? That's the unenlightened teacher, leader, teacher, leader. Maybe we'll just make them one hyphenated word now. The enlightened teacher is not seeking credit, is not seeking to be recognized. Again, that would be wanting something, would it not? Right? The enlightened teacher is just being with what is in front of them now to do. Right? So, Anne has quoted me here, and I'll repeat it again because it's good for all of us to hear it again. Nobody realizes anything until they realize it for themselves. Yeah, that's just a truth. That's just a truth. So the line we're looking at here, they work with myriad things but do not control. Again, what that says to me is on the outside, you know, you may not notice the enlightenment of the enlightened teacher. You may not notice the leader that is following the Tao, living by the Tao. You may not notice the one who is truly shepherding themselves, managing the work of detached actions. You may not notice unless you're really looking. But from the leader's perspective, there can't be concern about whether people notice. Right? For me, it's just doing what's in front of me to do now, without wanting anything, while inwardly shepherding myself. That's all there is. The next line says, they create but do not possess. Well, we can use the retreat house for an example, if you don't mind. And that is what this teaching is all about. Is that my retreat house? Is it Cheryl's retreat house? She lives there. Is it Jacqueline's retreat house? She's doing some of the grunt work right now, repairing ceilings and stuff. Right? You know, we're the ones that are working like crazy. You guys would not believe how hard we're working to open this retreat house. So do we own it? Do we get credit for the good that happens there or blame for the bad? One of the most important things for us to remember, Cheryl, Jacqueline, and anyone else who ends up being involved in the leadership of the retreat house, is that it's not ours. That's the most important thing we have to remember. It is not ours. It belongs to Fill in the blank. Consciousness, Holy Spirit, God, the guidance, spontaneity. We are its servants. It's not ours. And the moment we start thinking it is ours, we're going to screw things up. Our job, you know what Jesus said? Jesus said, the Son of Man has, oh, he says, what, foxes have dens. Does anybody remember the scripture? Foxes have dens. And then there was something else. Some other animal or fish had some place to live, right? Foxes have dens and something else. We'll say bears have caves, although I know Jesus didn't say that. Birds have nests. That's it. Foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Do you know what that means? That means he did not possess. He did not possess. You know, St. Francis, again, that was one of his primary teachings. And in fact, according to the biography, St. Francis, you know how Jesus went into the temple one day and started turning over tables? Well, Francis had a day like that, according to the biography, right? Francis got upset because I think he was in Israel for a while, and he came back from Israel, and there were a bunch of friars that had bought a house and were living in it as if it was their house. They were possessing the house. You know, it was, this is our house. When you come in here, you know, whatever, right? And he threw a fit, according to the biography. It also says he then calmed himself down. He then realized what he did, and he went back and handled it differently. But first, he threw a fit, according to the biography. Because one of his inward guidances was just this, not to possess. And the truth is, okay, this is going to be the guidance for anyone who is genuinely attempting to realize reality. This isn't a personal guidance. It's like St. Francis had guidance not to possess, but, you know, Eckhart Tolle, okay, it's okay if he possesses. You know, Eckhart Tolle may live in a nice house and whatever, whatever, but inwardly, there's no sense of possession, right? Certainly, if you guys know anything about Byron Katie, there's no sense of possession, even though she's a very rich woman. Nothing belongs to me. It all belongs to God. I am the servant, right? That's what this is talking about. They create. You know, they may make money. They may open retreat houses. They may start organizations, right? They create, but they do not possess. Who are we creating for? Well, what's genuinely happening is consciousness is coming through us, creating for consciousness. And that's exactly what the retreat house is, right? The retreat house came as guidance. Consciousness requested it for consciousness so that consciousness could awaken to itself. Who does the retreat house belong to? Consciousness. Yeah, Cheryl says, he is the potter, I am the clay. That's a little sign that Cheryl hung in the kitchen at the retreat house. He is the potter, I am the clay. So the enlightened leader creates, absolutely. Because the enlightened leader is the empty shell, and all of that guidance can come through an empty shell. So heck yeah, there's stuff going on. Heck yeah, stuff is being created, right? Heck yeah. But the enlightened leader doesn't see it as mine. You know, I don't think I ever refer to NTI as my book. You know, do you guys hear me say, did you read my book? You know, on page 345, it says blah, 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 or Inner Ramana. Did you read my book today? Did you guys get up and read my book? Did you read that book I wrote? I mean, have you guys ever heard me talk like that? Do you know why you don't hear me talk like that? I don't see them as my books. I've never seen them as my books. Right? I had to learn to let other people say to me, your book, you know, because in me, I wanted to say, no, it's not my book. And I had to learn, just allow that. You know, you don't need to be defending that it's not your book. That's also ego, right? Right? But there's no sense of possession. No sense of possession. Not with NTI, not with Inner Ramana, not with Awakening Together, not with the retreat house. No sense of possession. They act, but do not presume. Looking up, presume. Oh, wow, this is good. Suppose that something is the case or the basis of probability. Well, I'll tell you, this is one thing people do all the time. In fact, Jay, I'm going to use Jay again, but he caught himself doing this because I don't, and he was able to see the difference. You know, and I don't remember the specifics. I apologize. I just don't hold on to stories, therefore I can't remember stories. But so I'll talk about the retreat. I'm making up a story because I don't remember the actual situation. So this is made up. But let's say, Jay and I are walking along in Italy, and he says, well, now that you have the retreat house, are you going to do this, this, this in 2 months? You know, what retreat are you going to do in 4 months? Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, Jay, I don't know. You know, I mean, I don't know. I only know what I know. I can tell you what we've done so far. I can't tell you what's happening in the future. And I think we had 3 or 4 of those conversations. And finally, Jay was like, I get it. I'm trying to ask you to tell me what's going to happen in the future again. But you see, that's the presuming. The presuming is based on what I know, because it's already happened or because I've already received the guidance, then I can also predict the next step. Right? Yeah, Jay says after the 4th time he started to catch himself. I can also predict the next step. That's presuming. Right? And so the enlightened leader doesn't presume. I mean, to say that you don't know anything is foolishness. That's just not true for a human. You know, like I know I received the guidance to start a retreat house. I didn't know at that point when the retreat house would come about, what it would look like, but I knew something. I knew I had guidance to start a retreat house. And I also pretty much knew it would happen. I mean, because I trust guidance. You know, if guidance is asking me to do it, then it's probably going to happen. But I didn't know anything. I didn't know anything all the way up until we signed the papers on October 5th. I mean, it wasn't over till it was over. Believe me, with this particular situation. I didn't know that we had a retreat house until I signed it. So how could I presume what we were going to do after we got that retreat house? You know, I didn't even know for sure if we had one. I knew it looked like we might some days, and it looked like we might not some days. I had to watch to see how it played out. But the average person is always presuming. You know, they may receive guidance, legitimate guidance, but they can't just stop there. They have to add on and imagine and add this and think about that. And, you know, they can't just say, okay, here's what I know now, and that's all I know. Right? That's all I know. It's not that you don't know anything. You do know. When you receive guidance, you do know that much. Right? If you make an offer on a house, you do know that much. You made an offer. If the offer is accepted, you do know that much. The offer is accepted. But you got to know where what you know stops and where your imagination is beginning. Right? An enlightened leader knows the difference between what they know and what they don't know. And they're okay with not knowing. You got to be okay with not knowing. The average person wants to think they know. Hear that word, think. They want to think they know, and then they make up stuff in their own mind and believe that they know. They don't know the difference between what they actually know and their imagination. They make up stuff in their own mind, and then they believe their own imagination, and they think they know when they don't, right? And I think I have told you guys this story before about when I first saw that in myself. It's a very simple, simple, silly story. The realizations don't have to be phenomenal. But I was driving Jasmine to school, and you know, when, you know, anybody who drives a kid to school knows that There's a lot of routine happening at that time of day. School buses run at the same time every day. Certain parents are dropping their kids off at the same time every day. Certain things are happening. You kind of get to know the routine of the. And so there was this one school bus stop that we would drive by every day, and I even knew which kids stood there and everything. So, you saw it every day. And one day we drive by the bus stop, and there's a pickup truck parked there that's usually not there, with a couple of heads in it, a couple of people in it. And I turned to Jasmine and I said, they're keeping their kid in the truck today until the bus comes so their child doesn't have to stand in the cold. I made that up. I mean, maybe that was true, but do I know that? Do I know if that those two heads were people and their and a kid, a person and a kid? Do I know that they were keeping their kid in the truck so they wouldn't have to stand outside? Do I know anything? No. I mean, it hit me like a ton of bricks. It was a sudden realization. I just made that up. And then after I had that realization, I started seeing it all the time. I'd say something to Danielle and Jasmine, and I'd say, wait a minute, I just made that up. Another day, say, wait a minute, I just started seeing it all the time. Everybody does it. They just make stuff up all the time, presuming that they know when they don't. And then finally, I learned to stop doing that. And then I think it became a little annoying because, Jasmine and Danielle still wanted to hear what I was presuming. They trusted my presumptions, which was a little foolish because it was just made up stuff, but they had learned to trust my presumptions. So they'd ask me, well, what's going to happen tomorrow when blah, 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 or what's going to happen next week when blah, blah, blah? And I'd just say, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know the answer to that question. And it seems like for the next 2 or 3 years of my life, the most common thing that came out of my mouth was, I don't know the answer to that question, until finally they learned to quit asking. The enlightened leader does act, and the enlightened leader does know some stuff, right? Some stuff has been given to know. But the enlightened leader does not presume. We don't make up stuff and pretend to know it, right? Got to know the difference. I think I can finish these last three lines pretty quickly. They succeed, but do not dwell on success. And the reason they succeed is because they're the empty shell. Just following the guidance. They have no attachments. They're not trying to control. They're not possessing. They're not presuming. Therefore, they succeed. Thank you, Jacqueline. But they don't dwell on the success because they're not possessing that either. Have you guys ever heard me say, did you notice? Did you notice that I had guidance to get a retreat house and it happened? Did you notice my guidance happened? Have you ever heard me say that? Right? Of course not, because I don't possess. I don't possess the guidance. I don't possess the fruits of the guidance. Right? But this is where the success comes from. Isn't that funny? That is kind of why we have a retreat house. Because I was able to take the guidance one step at a time, be in trust, be not attached. Not presume, not possess. Because I was able to do all of that, we actually have a retreat house. And please don't interpret that as saying, did you notice? Right? I'm just saying that's the way it happens. So they succeed, but they don't dwell on the success. And then listen to the next line. It's because they do not dwell on success that it, meaning the success, never goes away. And I just said that it, meaning the success, never goes away, baby. I'll tell you a little more about what that success is. It is the Tao. It is the guidance. It is consciousness. Right? That success, that guidance, that Tao, that consciousness keeps unfolding, one creation after another, through the enlightened leader. Because they're not detached, they're not trying to control, they're not possessing, they're not presuming, they're inwardly shepherding. And so all of this can just keep unfolding. Anything can happen through an empty leader. And I'm going to make that lesson number two. That will be the title today. Anything can happen through an empty leader. And with that, I will let go of the mic. Thank you for the extra minute, Jacqueline.